to give you a plan of what I want to do next, and probably the rest of this lecture, and maybe some of tomorrow. So we left it at the definition of a type of groups where the elements depend on continuous parameters, and we call those Lie groups. So we are going to talk about Lie groups and Lie algebras. Then we have defined, once we have defined what a Lie group and a Lie algebra is, we'll move very quickly into doing a lot of stuff using a particular type of Lie group called SU2. You heard about SU2 before, it's not the first time, but we are going to define and use the SU2 a lot. In fact, we are going to first use it to discuss what you know already, so you know about rotations in a space which can be represented using the SU2 group. And also, we'll see how exactly the same group can be used to represent spin. The spin of any particle, actually. So we'll use the same group structure, mathematical structure, to define or to talk about something you can visualize and think about, which is rotations in space, so just moving around in three dimensions, and how exactly the same structure can be used to describe a spin, the same way that you, in quantum mechanics, you were talking about electrons being a spin up, a spin down, and then you probably also maybe you've seen a spin one particles as force mediators and so on. All the way to describe this is using SU2. Now, then we'll move into Lorentz symmetry. That's a symmetry that we assume is a fundamental symmetry of space-time. So we assume that space-time, or you know, the fundamental theory of space-time, will preserve that symmetry called Lorentz symmetry. So we'll talk about it. You'll see what kind of group structure it has. And it does connect again with SU2, because what we are going to see is that Lorentz symmetry actually can be written as two SU2s. It can be broken down, if you want, into two separate SU2s. And that will be our way, our gateway, to then be able to write theories of spin particles, fermions, spin two particles, anything, in a theory that is consistent with the Lorentz symmetry. Okay? Then, it's not all, SU2 is very, very useful. Of course, you know that Lorentz symmetry and imposing Lorentz symmetry will lead to your usual theory for special relativity and your usual special relativity mechanics. But that's for mechanics when you also want to take into account not just movement in space and time, but also the spin characteristics of particles, then you need to take into account this SU2 cross SU2. So we will do that. And finally, we will give yet another use to our SU2 algebra to use SU2 to define or to talk about isospin. Isospin is essentially a way of understanding nuclear interactions. Which is based on SU2, and how we are going to write down a theory for nucleons, and then we are going to use symmetries to univocally also realize what are the interactions between nucleons and pions, which are the force mediators. So many, many uses of SU2. So once you are fed up with SU2, I hope you're not fed up, it's really fun. And you know, the good thing about SU2 is a minimum rank that you get something non-abelian, so you get something kind of interesting. And it's not as boring as SU3, where everything is big and, like, you know, you gluons. Who remembers the Gell-Mann matrices? I don't. But. Well, if you do, that's fine. We'll move on into then. talking about gauge symmetries and how those have been the way to actually understand forces, quantum mechanics. So that will be a big thing. So we will understand how forces are actually nothing but a manifestation of a local symmetry. And they are there, you need to put them to make the whole theory consistent. So those forces are experienced, and the fact that you need this force mediator and the spin of this force mediator, the way everything behaves is actually a manifestation of this symmetry principle. Very cool. Okay, so at this point we will have a good collection of symmetries. And we will have how to use, we'll know how to use some symmetries, local, global, and so on and so forth. And then we start doing the funny stuff. Once we talk about symmetries, what we want to do is to break them. We love breaking things. First, we understand them, we build them, and then we break them. That's like a child, essentially. Okay, so we'll do two types of breaking. We'll take a global symmetry, a continuous global symmetry, and we will break it in a way that is spontaneous. And I will explain what spontaneous is. And then we will use this example as a building block to understand the spontaneous symmetry breaking of a local symmetry or a gauge symmetry, which, as you know, is, in the case of the standard model, is the Higgs mechanism.
A
spontaneous symmetry breaking.
No, it's good.
Now, the global symmetry, when it's a continuous one, when it breaks, it will lead to something that is also very interesting, which is a new type of particles called Goldstone bosons. You haven't heard about that, them, Goldstone bosons. Well, so we'll talk about them. Okay, so that's the idea, that's the plan. And I don't know if I will get to the end today, but that's no problem. Otherwise, tomorrow. Okay. Fine. So let's start with this. Again, coming back to Lie groups and Lie algebras. It's just a fancy name of a type of group. We're saying, okay, so if I have a group element, let's call it G. And now it depends on a parameter. And I wanted you to keep this kind of intuition of this being, for example, real rotations in 3D, with the idea that you can do three types of elementary rotations. So you can do one along the x-axis, y-axis, and z-axis. And these rotations can be infinitesimal, or they can depend on an angle. So any rotation of any kind in three dimensions can be built with successive rotations along the x, the y, and the z axis. Is that clear? And any rotation of any angle can be built out of infinitesimally small rotations. So having this in mind, what we are going to do is to say, well, okay, so sometimes we get more intuition and a better understanding of the underlying features of our theory by, instead of focusing on rotations of generic rotations, for example, I could say my generic rotation can be written as some kind of exponential of some parameter. And then I have a multiplication over this. So let me explain this. I can always write any generic rotation as being generated by essentially no rotation plus a number of rotations, and that's what this parameter is about, along all the axes. So A here is 1, 2, 3, and it just means x, y, and z, plus order alpha squared. So all what I'm doing is to say that a finite rotation in an arbitrary direction can be built up by doing infinitesimal rotations in along all possible directions, x, y, and z with parameters f alpha a. Is this clear? If not, I can explain differently. Okay. So instead of using J, because that's for rotations, or we are used to think on J as of rotations, let me talk about the name that is put of tennis T. So instead of thinking of rotations, let me just think about any symmetric transformation, and let me write any finite symmetric transformation as a convolution, if you want, of symmetry transformations, infinitesimal symmetry transformations along all the possible axes. Okay, so these guys, this TA, I'm sure you heard about those before. Those are the generators of the symmetry group. If I know the TA, those guys, I have identified how to do any kind of finite symmetry transformation. I just need to exponentiate it, and then I will have it. Is this clear?
Then you also need your alpha
A's. Alpha A's is just a name for a possible coefficient in front. Okay. All what I'm saying is a linear combination of these, in this case, these three guys, with coefficients up to you. Any more questions? Okay, cool. So those members here, if they form a group, they will be a Lie group. And the generators of the Lie group, they also form their own structure, and it's called a Lie algebra. So what we are going to do is to characterize the Lie algebra.
Sorry, can you repeat the difference between the group and the algebra?
Yes. So a group is what we discussed this morning. It's a group of elements with a multiplication rule, with a given set of rules, of constraints. So for example, you think on rotations in three dimensions, you can think on the elements of your group to be any kind of rotation of angle theta. Now, at the infinitesimal level, when you just move a little bit away from nothing, from one, I can see what is the underlying structure. And the underlying structure is that anything can be built up these little guys over here, the generators. So the way these generators behave, and that's what we are going to describe right now, is actually containing the same information as the Lie group. So what these generators are going to do, the way they behave, and that will lead to commutation relations, is what is constitutes the Lie algebra. It's essentially a way of translating the rules we heard about the group into the rules that then you have to have on your generators. That's the algebra.
Yeah. So this morning I thought you said like multiplication, you know, you had to have a law to find a group. I thought it was an example. But what you said that just now sounds like it has to be multiplication. Like you can't define a group with addition or something.
Yeah, you can.
Okay.
It's just that you need to call it to the operation, the way you make elements talk to each other, mm-hmm. in some way.
Okay.
You can call it multiplication.
Okay.
Any more questions? Cool. So now, what is this Lie algebra? This Lie algebra is information that we are going to learn about the generators themselves, not the group elements, the generators themselves, which will encode the same information as the group. And why do we want to go one step further or one step below? It's because it's at the level of the algebra that we are going to be able to see relations among different symmetric groups. I don't know if you ever heard about isomorphisms between different symmetry groups. This comes by understanding the algebra. Okay, so how do we get this algebra? We use the associativity that we were talking about this morning. Groups don't have to be a billion. They don't have to have AB equals BA, but they have to be associative. And for example, we can think on go back to you onto your the idea of having a rotation. And let's say I go from an element, let me use the same from an element, I got to go to an, want to go to another element doing a rotation, and then another element and another element. So I want to, for example, rotate all the way to 360. Why not? So what I know is if I take an element of the group, so in a finite rotation, and then I say, well, that's going to be alpha times, where alpha is a parameter, my generators of the group. And then I'm going to apply a second rotation. It's not going to be alpha times, let me call it beta now, TA. These two elements of the group, when one is applied after the other, what I know is that I had to end up having a rotation. So this has to be written in some way that looks like, let's say, gamma TA. So the successive application of a symmetry operation and then another symmetry operation has to be a symmetry operation. That's the statement. Now, these TAs here, you can think on them again back to this intuition of having rotations. Rotations are 3x3 matrices that act on three vectors, right? So in principle, these TAs, these generators, are matrices. So think on them in generic terms as being matrices. And what it means then, as you know already, this is not going to be simply the sum of alpha plus beta. We will have other conditions. And then you have this Baker, Campbell, Hausdorff formula, and then you expand and on, so on and so forth. All the math. At the end, what happens is that you can go from this, which hopefully you have understood, you see the intuition of that, into a statement about what is the commutator between two T's. So for this to be realized, I can expand at low values for alpha and beta, so infinitesimal parameters. And what this is saying is that the commutation of two of these generators had to lead to another generator. Okay? And the rest is just making sure we put labels to things. So TA TB equals some new element of the group. And then let me keep track of the indices here. So I will say ABC. And let me be anal and put an I here just to bother people. So that's the idea.
In the equation you've written, they're all TAs and just relations of the same.
Those
you
are.
Use that to make a statement about relations between multiple generators.
So you know about the Einstein dummy variables, right?
This is
linear combination of these guys. Linear combination of these guys. Linear combination. So in general, what you are going to get is this is only satisfied at linear order in these parameters if you satisfy something like this. What are these FA? This FA is something to determine. Every different symmetry group will have a different set of FAs. So when I take two of the commutators on my symmetry group, take the commutator, I will get a new element of the group, of the algebra, up to this parameter here. And this is called essentially, let me just make sure I get the
structure constant?
Yes, structure constant. I assume some of you have seen this when you do your standard model courses or in quantum field theory. So those are the structure constants. And those, knowing those for your group of symmetry, allows you also to write down what kind of interactions you can have. So we are going to get there. But for the moment, these FA, BC are just something that is keeping track of when two of these guys commute, where is the coefficient in front? That's all. Okay, so those are called structure constants. Very good. So any questions? Everything is clear?
That's good.
Okay. So once we have done that, we are going to do the following. Bye. So from all the possible FABC that I could write down, let me write FABC, this guy, this structure constant, to be a specific type of structure constant. I'm going to make a choice. I'm going to say that FABC is actually the Levi Civita symbol. Is everybody happy with that? Cool. So I'm going to say that I'm going to study a type of symmetry or Lie algebra where if I take these two guys, I do recover another element of the algebra with my usual I in front, and the parameter, the structure constant in front, is simply the Levi Civita. Is everybody happy with Levi Civita? Just a choice. So that's SU2. That's SU2. That statement, which I said, okay, the structure constants are the Levi Civita, that's our basis to understand SU2. As you can imagine, with that choice, then there is a plethora of all ways in which we can actually represent this. I told you this morning that even for a simple case like the Z3, we had two simple, completely different ways of representing Z3 symmetries. Here it's going to be the same. You can represent these TAs in many different ways. And each different way will lead to each different physics. Okay, so for example, one choice we could make for the representation is we could say that maybe the TA themselves, TA is nothing but a matrix, I told you, and we could say that this matrix, this could be of any size. I could put any dimension I want to this matrix. I'm going to make a choice just because I want, and I'm going to say that now this matrix is going to have the same dimension as the set of my generators. So, to be clear, for example, if we are again talking about rotations, we say we have three possible rotations, right? And we have three types of rotations, and each of these rotations is a 3x3 matrix. But it doesn't have to be. You could also have this being a completely different thing. It's up to you. So what we are going to do is to say, as a first example, I'm going to build each of these generators as a matrix that contains, if this is 3, it will be 3x3. If it's 2, 2x2, and so on and so forth.
Could they be higher
ranked
than the matrix?
Yes, they could be, yes. Okay, good. And again, I can choose any representation as long as these guys and those choices I make satisfy this algebra. So one trivial way in which you can satisfy this algebra is that this, the elements of this matrix are nothing but this. So I take the structure functions as being precisely the elements, the way I'm filling those matrices, and choosing a representation for this symmetry transformation. And this type of choice is called the adjoint. I'm sure you heard the word adjoint before, yes.
So to be clear, if we stick general with F, then putting F there when we're doing this matrix thing, that's the adjoint representation.
Exactly, for any kind, exactly. So if instead of epsilon for the SU2 case, I did the Gell-Mann matrices, then I have the adjoint representation. And that's why the gluons are in that representation. So what we will learn later on is that if we want to represent forces using symmetries, or gauge symmetries in this case, the force mediators will be precisely manifesting themselves as in the adjoint representation. So we are going to see that later. Okay, so you build your matrices, and let me give you an example. So what would you do? You could do T1, the first one, and that would be I times, I can just write it, and you can think about this so it gets a bit more. So 0, 0, 0. I should know this by heart, but 0, 0, -0, +0. You can do T2 the same way, T3 the same way. You see, they are, the plus and minus is +1 and -1. What this represents is the infinitesimal generators of rotations. Okay? So the representation of SU2 in the adjoint is precisely the same matrices you will use to build up rotations in three dimensions. Exactly the same. So that's your Jx, your Jy, and your Jz infinitesimal. Is this clear to everybody? Or not? There you go.
Is the representation in a specific dimension unique? Or can you have more than one representation
as,
in every dimension? No, right?
No, as far as I know. Because you need to make sure that this equation is correct. I might be wrong, but I never thought about it. But
so I guess my question is, what you mean by different representation is in fact a different dimension.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. Or even as we were. But this is constricted to matrices, right? We can also think on groups in more generic ways, like we were thinking on groups are these solutions for an algebraic equation. And we can think on groups also in terms that are computer graphical and so on. Yes?
You can get lots of other representations in the same dimension, right?
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Doing a similarity transformation.
Yeah.
Any inner automorphism would give loads of representation for this.
Yeah, you can add faces up to faces. And but remember that the isomorphism, the fact that the groups are isomorphic to each other, that's precisely, you see, because the generator algebra is the same. So, more questions? Good. Are you sure? Okay, cool. So what we've seen is we've written down what is the algebra for a group. We'll say, let's do a simple choice. Let's say that the structure constants are the Levi-Civita. And among all the things I could be doing, I say, why don't I choose then that the matrices themselves, the generators themselves, are simply the structure functions? That this has a name, has very specific physical meaning, and for example, it leads to rotations in three dimensions. But you already know that it also leads to force mediators, the way we actually think about force mediators. Any more questions? Okay, so apart from using these 3x3 matrices, another simple way of representing SU2 is something you already heard about before probably, is using the Pauli matrices. So you can decide that your generators are going to be simply your Pauli matrices.
Is that a tau?
It's a tau, yeah, my tau.
It looks like a tau, there's one picture.
No, I'm terrible. My taus are awful, and then my sigmas are even worse. Like, that's my sigma. That's all I can do. Well, you know the Pauli matrices. Yeah. One, two. You know them better than me, so I'm sure. 1, 0, 0, 0, and you know tau 3, your famous been. So you can also verify that you take these three matrices, they will satisfy the algebra that we have above. And we indeed get precisely this connection over here. Now we are representing the same symmetry group with a different dimensionality. Now we are talking about 2x2 matrices. And as you know, this is also what you use when you are thinking about the spin properties of, for example, an electron. So you are thinking about the electron sometimes as being a spin up and a spin down, and you think on the Pauli matrices as a way of transforming the spin properties of the electron. Okay, so that's good. So just to sum up, both the TI here that I used in the adjoint representation, or the sigma, the Pauli matrices, so let me do tau and be consistent. Those are different ways of representing the same algebra. If you take them, those are differential, right? Infinitesimal transformations. If you take them and then you exponentiate them, what you are going to end up is with finite transformations, symmetry transformations, rotations, ways of changing the spin of your electron and so on. And it will lead to SU2. But in the case of three-dimensional rotations, actually the group you are thinking of is the special orthogonal transformations in three dimensions. So let me go back for a second. I told you that SU2 is represented by this choice of the algebra, where the Levi-Civita is a structure function. I told you that a choice is actually to build these matrices, this representation, using the Levi-Civita. And you already identified that this is actually also the generators of rotations in 3D. Now, if you take all the possible rotations in three dimensions, they do form a group, a finite group, that is essentially matrices that are orthogonal, and you can build them being special. So determinant unity in three dimensions, and that's called SO3. The only thing we've done is to identify that at the infinitesimal level, there is a relation between SU2 and SO3. And that's what we call an isomorphism. So things that look different, if you look at a finite rotation or if you look at the behavior of electrons, they actually share the same underlying features. And the isomorphism is just saying that, okay, these two guys are not exactly the same when you do a finite transformation, but infinitesimally they are.
So diagonality
in the matrices,
does it mean the product of any two is zero as
the vectors? So or you take a matrix, you have the identity.
Okay.
Yes, orthogonal ritual. Any more questions? Very good. So we have done this, finding representations that correspond to dimension of 3x3 matrices, 2x2 matrices, and in fact, you can do it for any number as long as you satisfy the rules or the algebra, the Lie algebra. So you can do that, and for any, and in fact, use these representations of SU2 of different dimensionality to encode information about the spin. So for a particle of a spin S, you need to write down matrices that are, or representations that are of these dimensions, 2S plus 1, 2S plus 1, in the context of SU2. And those matrices will contain the internal information about spin S. So we seem for spin 1/2, that that corresponded to having a 2x2 matrix. I told you about force mediators. These guys are spin one. So you end up with 3x3 matrices. Spin zero is just a function. It's not a matrix, doesn't have a matrix. You can do exactly the same with spin two. You can do it with higher spins even. So we know there are spin zero particles, the Higgs, pions, and so on and so forth. We know of matter, electrons, tops, and so on, that are spin one half. We know of spin one particles, which are the force mediators, the photon, gluon, WZ, but also resonances in QCD. For example, the rho, the A1, and so on, are spin one particles. Also in QCD, QCD is a jungle. It's just still forms any kind of bound state, and it has been observed bound states of spin 2, spin 3, spin 4, spin 5. Really, everything, they do it. So there are also particles of this spin. It's called the F2, and there are others, and higher spin even. So the way you will go about sitting down and writing a theory for your spin 3 particle in QCD will be very difficult, because we don't know how to write a quantum field theory of spin 3. But at least you will know what kind of symmetry information should contain. And it should be in a representation of SU2 of that dimensionality. And the same for spin 2, spin 1, and so on. So same structure, just different ways of looking at the same thing. And it leads to force mediators, the possible graviton, exactly, because if there were a graviton, a mediator of the gravitational interactions, it would also be in the spin 2 representation of SU2. It's a way of thinking about rotations and so on and so forth. Any questions? Yes?
Okay, so for the graviton, so usually you would represent it as a matrix 4x4, and this, like, from this you would expect rather 5x5.
Mm-hmm.
So like four different particles.
So I was just thinking whether, see, you have done quantum field theory, you know that we represent, for example, a photon as being an A-mu,
right,
that has in principle four components, but it doesn't, right? It has only two polarizations. The same here, you will have the H-mu, the graviton, is represented as a 4x4.
Like a 5 vector or something.
Yes?
Is it true that if the particle is massive, then there's 2J+1 degrees of freedom? If it's massless, there's always 2, right?
Well, the way you would represent, then you need to...
It's massless.
So the way you will represent it, you will need that dimensionality, and then there will be constraints.
Yeah.
More questions? Yes?
Why isn't there s equals 3 over 2?
Ah, if it's spin 3, good question.
No, in the middle, 3 halves.
Sorry?
3 halves. It's just it missed in the...
Ah, yes. In fact, yeah, very good question. So what about S equals 3 halves? As far as I know, there is no such guy or being observing QCD
No.
I might be wrong. But there is, in supersymmetry, if supersymmetry existed, the supersymmetric partner of the graviton will be the gravitino. And that will be a guy, gravitino, that has a spin 3 halves. And for that, there is even a Lagrangian one can write down, is the Rarita Schwinger Lagrangian. So yeah, that would be the same. More questions? Cool. Okay. So now, we've done the SU2. We talked about the way we define it and some ways in which we can represent it. Let's move to the next stage, which is talking about the Lorentz symmetry. Lorentz symmetry is a symmetry that we believe the structure of space-time has. And when you impose that symmetry, then you get a lot of, you know, essentially you get everything that you have learned about special relativity. Okay, so. Where is the Lorentz symmetry? The Lorentz symmetry is a transformation that you can do on a space-time coordinates. So let's say I start with x mu, where this is my space-time coordinates, and I do a transformation on them. So for example, I take those. That's a four vector. I multiply it by a, let me use another notation, 4 by 4 matrix. So I take my four vector and transform it in a way. And I'm going to then consider transformations of space-time coordinates that leave something invariant, that preserve something that I consider important. So what is what I'm going to consider important is the space-time interval. You heard about the space-time interval. Right? Any event, you can always take a combination of its time and its space separation. So in this case, this space-time interval will be something where you sum over mu on nu. And then this eta mu is the Minkowski metric. And it's a metric that you can essentially differentiate between time and space. And sometimes the choice is to make it mostly minus or mostly plus. It doesn't matter. It's just something that tells you that time and space are different. Have you seen this before, Minkowski metric? You know what I'm talking about, the space-time interval. It's essentially your usual C dt square minus the space separation. That's your space-time interval. Now, what I'm going to do is to say, well, among all the possible transformations that I could do to space-time, I'm going to focus on the ones that do preserve that particular quantity. I'm going to make that quantity special. And that is going to span a group of symmetry. And that group is going to be the Lorentz group. And we believe that that's something, or well, we believe, we see in nature that this is something that seems to be satisfied indeed. And imposing that symmetry will tell you what kind of terms you are allowed in your Lagrangian, and it will lead to your typical Einstein equations from a special relativity. So starting from a symmetry principle, I believe that from all the transformations, the one that preserve this guy are very important. And that then leads to consequences, like for example, the only or the element that you can write in your action has to be proportional to this space-time interval. And once you have that in place, then you can then recover the usual special relativity mechanics. By the way, you ever want to see a very, very nice derivation of this particular action principle for special relativity, I will say the Landau-Lipschitz. I'm not sure I'm going to pronounce this correctly. I'm sure this is wrong. Russian name. A classical field theory. That is a beautiful book. And when it comes at least to explain how special relativity, you know, all this beautiful Einstein theory and all these transformations and so on, they actually come from an action principle and from using a symmetry. And this is the symmetry I want to preserve, Lorentz symmetry. Okay, so that's it. Then our task is to characterize these lambdas over here. So which kind of 4 by 4 matrices do preserve the space-time interval? And then we will take those matrices, expand them infinitesimally, and then we will find the algebra that corresponds to the Lorentz group. Okay? Shall we do that? I need to do this because then I want to show you how at the level of the algebra, actually this Lorentz group can be written as two SU2s. And that will be, as I told you, our gateway to write consistent theories of spin one half, spin one particles in a way that is consistent with Lorentz invariants. So let's do that. I don't want to, you know, drown you with math. There's not much point. This can be found in, I will say, in many places. Your Chai book on group theory is good. I'm not sure that it does the Lorentz invariance to SU2 cross SU2, but otherwise, I'm sure there are other places where this is done. And if not, ask me. I can send you the notes. But okay, so what do we do? Essentially, this statement about I want to preserve the space-time interval tells you something about how these matrices are, and this statement ends up being something like eta mu nu lambda lambda has to be essentially leading to the Minkowski metric again. So I just put alpha beta, and then I have to do alpha beta, and then eta mu nu and this. So my matrices, lambda, that are going to, 4x4 matrices that are going to preserve the space-time interval, that we're going to preserve Lorentz invariants, are precisely the ones that satisfy this condition. Now, if it wasn't for this Minkowski metric over here, and you just had a signature plus, plus, plus to everybody or minus to everybody, we will know what this is. This is just saying the 4x4 matrices that are orthogonal to each other. But there is this guy here bothering us, signifying that time and space are slightly different. So instead of being just rotations or orthogonal rotations in 4x4 matrices, which is what you would have if it wasn't for this, instead we get rotations, but now they have a signature 3,1. And this is just to say there are rotations that are orthogonal up to this distinction between the space and time. Okay, so that's the symmetry group that corresponds to Lorentz transformations. So the type of transformations I can make on my space-time coordinates that still do preserve the space-time interval. And those are specific types of matrices given by this. So this is the group, the finite group, that contains these kind of finite transformations. Let's go deeper. So let's go take these guys and expand them differentially, because it is there at the differential level that we see connections with other groups. Okay? So all what I'm saying here is that you can think on this expression as being some matrix lambda transpose multiplied by your vector eta times lambda has to give you back your vector eta. The kind of matrices that do that is what we call orthogonal rotations of signature 3,1. And that's the Lorentz group. So that's the Lie group. Those are the representations. So once we choose a representation for lambda, that will be the representation of the Lie group, those lambdas over here. But we are going to now think about the algebra. So we need to take this lambda that is going to depend on a set of parameters that we are varying. And we are going to take this lambda and we are going to expand it infinitesimally. So what kind of coordinate transformations can you do? What types of coordinate transformations? Okay, so in the context of the special relativity, you will think on rotations and boosts, right? So things that mix time and space. So pure three-dimensional and things that change time and space. Is this clear? Yes. Very good. I'm not doing time translations yet. That's another separated thing from Donesby. Okay, so the kind of transformations that preserve the space-time interval are going to be precisely the rotations and boosts. Remember, you probably know, you've seen this in special relativity courses. Rotations are things that essentially change coordinates in three dimensions, and boosts are things that are going from x to t and vice versa. So they are mixing both things. Okay, so let's do that. So what we are going to do is express these lambdas over here, the generators of, sorry, the matrices of the Lorentz transformations, and we are going to try to find out what are the generators of the Lorentz group. Okay, so let me, if you want, think about a representation. Let me call it omega of my Lorentz transformation as some kind of exponentiation of my generators of my Lorentz transformation. Let me call these generators M mu. Okay? And the only thing I need to do is to make sure that I put the correct factors in front and I have enough parameters in front as to sum over. Okay? That will be a finite Lorentz transformation. And this M mu that we are going to determine in a second, those are the generators of a Lorentz transformation. Those generators are going to contain the infinitesimal rotations and infinitesimal boosts. That's what they are going to contain inside. Now, as you had said before already, another transformation that I can do to space-time coordinates is time translation. I can just change from t to t plus something. So those translations are indeed things that I can do to my coordinates. And how do I call them? For example, I could do that x goes to x. Let's say it's a four vector plus a constant four vector. Those are my translations. So the Lorentz transformations and the translations, those two things together, are the whole set of transformations that I can do in space-time, and that I do believe, well, I do believe. I don't believe anything, but sorry to say, that those two guys together form a bigger group of symmetries that is called the Poincaré group. Essentially, all what we are doing is to say, I'm thinking about the space-time, I'm thinking about possible things that I can do to a coordinate of space and time. I can rotate it, I can boost it, and I can translate it. And if I put it all together, that will generate this Poincaré group. So if we want to then think of a generic Poincaré transformation, we can then expand this and say, well, I can also think of doing as well a translation, and what this is telling me is that I will have another term over here with a generator. And the only thing I need in front is some kind of vector. Okay, is this clear? So we are almost there. All what we are saying is we are thinking about the way nature will work, and when it comes to space-time coordinates, you've seen before that there is some kind of relations between different descriptions of coordinates, and that then, the physics might be invariant under those coordinate transformations. But what kind? Well, the Lorentz transformations, Boost rotations, and translations seem to be a good set of things. So now what I want to do is to actually characterize those generators. So think on a mu and omega mu nu. It's nothing but a parameter. It's the alpha that we had before. It's a number. It's how much I'm going in this direction or that direction or that direction. And all these guys that we want to characterize. So we need to understand how they do commute. And we want to understand the algebra of the Poincaré group. So we want to understand how the generator M commutes with generator M, the generator P of translations commutes with P, and what happens, and that's the important thing also, is when M and P talk to each other. Is the Poincaré group really a group by itself? It's a closure. So we want to develop these three commutators. Now, as you can imagine, these guys and menu being is quite difficult, not difficult, but it's quite messy when you start looking at the way these behave. Let me just give you an explicit form of F menu, so you know what I'm talking about, and then I'll give you the answer. So you take those generators of rotations and boosts and translations, and then you work out all these commutators, then we will get the algebra of the Poincaré group. So that's what we are looking for. So first of all, I'll give you some form for a menu.
Because getting between n comma p and certainly p comma l because of dimensionality depending on how you arrange your vector in the matrix seems not trivial.
You have to make sure they are the same.
So yeah. Can you speak a little bit louder? Otherwise, we cannot hear the questions.
Yes.
No, for questions.
Ah,
maybe you can repeat the question.
Yeah. What she was asking, and it's a very good question, is when I'm talking about this, I want to obtain the algebra. And that's talking about mixing different objects, in this case, this M versus this P. If I want to talk about a commutator, I better be able to actually multiply these two things together. They don't have to be necessarily the same order, but you have to be able to obtain this commutator. So the representation matters. Very good. So just you get a better intuition about what this beast menu is. It's a 4x4 matrix, right? Made of 4x4 matrices. So let me show you what it is. It's essentially 0, k1, k2, k3. And then the same is anti-symmetric. And then, so k's are the generators of boosts. And then the rest is filled with rotations in three dimensions. So pure space rotation. So it's an anti-symmetric matrix. So it has zeros in the diagonal. One side is minus the other side. It has a very specific structure. And then you have minus J3, J2, J1, and then the opposite here. So essentially, the generator of the Lorentz group happens to be made of the component 0i, so the one that goes over here, where I is 1, 2, 3, and 0 corresponds to the first entry. You tell me if I'm assuming you guys have done some GR, so you are used to this kind of notation. If not, I can go slower. I see lots of notes. So very good. So N0i is nothing but the boost along the I direction. And the Mij is, surprise, surprise, minus I epsilon ij, ijk, ijk, and then the rotation along the k direction. Okay? Very good. So remember that those rotations are actually matrices themselves. So this matrix is a 4x4 matrix made of matrices as entries. It's rather complicated. So that's what makes everything a tiny bit complicated. I'm not going to write the whole expression, but the upshot is when you take this beast and then p mu, and then you do work out what is the commutator of m with m will lead to a bunch of m's. So eta multiplied by m in different combinations of indices. When you do p with p, you will get zero. So the translation part of the Poincaré group, which is generated by p, is actually an abelian group, okay? And the way we see that it's abelian is because the commutator is zero. And finally, and that's the key thing, is when we take m with p, when the Lorentz transformations are talking to the translations, they actually do not commute. So they talk to each other, they mix with each other. And they lead to something that goes as a linear combination of theta times p.
You drew a sheriff line at the base of the P. I'm not sure if that is a different P than the other.
P. That P. Yes, indeed. Very good. So there is a lot of math in between, but let's not get math, blinding us from what we care about. After lots of math, what you realize is that taking the Poincaré group, thinking about the Lorentz part, and also thinking about the translation part, leads to a rather like convoluted kind of algebra, where m with m leads to m. So that's in itself is just leading again to another generator of the same Lorentz group. P with p leads to nothing, so that's good. It's abelian, it's very simple. But this last guy is essentially mixing the two sectors, the two things. So it's only the whole Poincaré group that is in closure, okay? Because a transformation that has to do Lorentz symmetry and translations, they are not going to commute with each other. And the non-commuting will be precisely proportional to the translation P.
When you have those coefficients there, eta, you're actually, there's Minkowski matrices involved, like those are the coefficients.
Exactly. And the form is essentially all the possible combinations that you can imagine of indices here, and all these guys, there's many terms. Doesn't contain more information of what I'm saying, which is, this transformation is talking to itself.
Yeah.
This is abelian, but this thing is really moving from one to the other.
What is the dimension of the eta p product? What class of object is that when you multiply those two together?
So maybe if I put it explicitly, it will be easier. So let me write this one, since it's the simplest, explicitly. The commutator, let's say, of m nu do it in a way that is a bit more appealing. So let me do p, let me do m, and let's say p mu, just filling indices, alpha, beta, okay? And that is going to be proportional to p. There is always an I in front bothering us. And then we have a combination of eta p and eta p. Okay? And all what I'm going to do is to mix these indices over here. And this alpha mu, p beta, and then beta mu, p alpha. More questions? Yes.
Yeah, you said that only the combination of the p's and the m's is closed.
In the sense that if you take a Lorentz transformation and another Lorentz transformation, they will lead to a Lorentz transformation. These translation things don't do much. You see, they even commute with each other. But it's when you are trying to simultaneously doing a Lorentz transformation and a translation that, see, because they don't commute with each other, the result, the difference between these two, doing one order or the other way, is precisely a translation. And what it means is that if you want to think about the whole set of transformations you can make, and in whatever order you want, and you want to be able to capture all these symmetries, you cannot just neglect translations. You just need to take into account the whole group, the whole Poincaré group, because that is a statement that Lorentz transformations and translations do talk to each other. I think it's going to be more clear in a second, because what I'm going to do is try to get away from that. The physics of this is kind of entangled with each other. It's the right way of thinking because you already have a built-up intuition of using special relativity. You know about boosts, you know about rotations, you know about translations, you know what it means, you know how to build theories based on that. But at the level of the algebra, this is not the most clarifying structure. So can we kind of massage all this, this algebra of the Poincaré group in a way that becomes clear? And that's what we are going to do next. Okay, that's what we are going to do. We are going to show that actually this algebra can be rewritten as two separate SU2s. Okay, so let's do that. Unless you have more questions. As an intermediate step, let me show you what this algebra means in terms of not the m's here, but of the actual rotations and boosts, because maybe the physical intuition is better in that case. So those exact algebra, the Lie algebra of the Poincaré group, can be also be written as JJ, the rotations lead to blah, 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 J. KK, boost, leads to something that is essentially just another J. Whereas the boost rotation leads to a boost. Okay, so.
Two boosts is a rotation?
Okay, it's still a mess, isn't it? All mixing with each other. I don't like messes. And it's indicative that something could be there. So it might be an underlying structure. Now we even have maybe a way in, because we know that the rotations here are nothing but a way of representing SU2. Right? It's just another way of representing SU2. So at that level, we might be able to find a relation between this complicated thing or that complicated thing and SU2s. Okay, so shall we do it? Any questions, by the way? Am I going too fast? I'm killing you with math, no? Yes?
This is only because you are involving time in here, right? If you take time away, then that figures at the end of KJ becomes zero.
And then you get one SU2 and you're happy. Yeah. What we were saying before, that rotations in 3D or 3 is actually isomorphous to SU2. Yeah. But now time is there. So So can we deal with a special relativity situation? Okay, so this is, just to reiterate, this is the algebra of S of 3,1 is the kind of transformations that leave the space-time interval the same. So no matter what reference system you're looking at, it is the space-time interval that will be the same, and hence is a good, or is what you are going to use in your Lagrangian. So, I don't know why I erased them. Let me be again more explicit about this. I say that two rotations do not commute and lead to a rotation. Did I tell you also what kind of parameter was in front? It's just epsilon. So if I say ij, I will say ijk, and that will be k. No surprises there. So that's SU2 for you. Then ki, kj, this guy, do not commute with each other, and instead they lead to a rotation. And then the K and J, as we are, JJ is, and then leads to a boost. It's like we do have two SU2s, they are just mixed with each other. So is there any linear combination of these K's and J's that we can write down and then kind of disentangle these two sectors? Can we separate the Lorentz symmetry into two separate SU2s? And as the answer is, of course, yes. And the only thing you need to do is, as usual in particle physics, is take a linear combination with one of the guys being a complex. So with the j times ik, or j minus ik will be these two. So we can define a combination of j and k, which is essentially j plus ik, and another combination that will be with a minus. Very good. I have 15 minutes. That's really good. The only thing I need to do is to put indices here. I put a factor 1/2 for convenience. This is this. And then if I do this, you won't be surprised to hear that then this combination, symmetric and anti-symmetric, if you want, of S, S times S, this commutator leads to an S, up to stuff. A times A, commutator leads back to A, and there is no longer a mixed commutator between these two. So that's the new algebra. The only thing we've done is to re-express the algebra of the Lorentz group, S of 3,1, including translation, so the Poincaré group, which seem to be a kind of a mess, but it's a mess that we understand. It's a mess that we have an intuition about. And at the level of the algebra, and only at the level of the algebra, it's been pretty easy to then realize that the whole algebra actually is the same as one SU2 and another SU2 that do not talk to each other, that are decoupled from each other. Well, it looks like they are decoupled, right? Because we had the commutator to be zero. It's not.
Sorry, where have we included the translations?
The translations is P.
Yeah. So we're working with J and K, right?
Which is part of them.
Yes.
We seem to mislay the P's somewhere, and that doesn't seem to be included in the SU2.
I know what you mean, sorry. The translation is P, is over here. And then what you are telling me is, what I'm doing actually is to try and to separate over here this,
yeah,
this guy. Sorry, yeah. I don't know what I'm thinking about. So the only thing I'm doing is to take the SO3,1 part, just the Lorentz part of the symmetry, and then separate it as a cross product between two SU2s. Is it still true that you will have the translations and they will not commute with your SO3,1? Thank you so much. Any more? Thank you for catching me. Very good. Okay. So, everybody happy so far? So all this stuff was to say that our original SO3,1 Lorentz group is isomorphous. At the level of the Lie algebra, they behave the same as two SU2s. Usually we call these two SU2s left and right, for reasons that you can already guess, just to give them a name. And since we know that each SU2, we can choose the representations of SU2 that corresponds to some given spin, then we can think about ways in which particles or states are going to behave that are essentially written in that form. So for example, I can think on objects that are under the first SU2 transforms as spin n, and under the second SU2 transform as spin m. Okay? And then I'm going to be able to relate these representations of particles that have a spin n under SU2 left or m under SU2 right as objects that have some structure in the Lorentz symmetry. Okay? Now, it's not true that these two guys are independent, in the sense that there is something we can do. We can apply parity. You know about parity, the transformation of space-time. And then, under parity, k goes to minus k, j is unchanged. And then what happens is that s will transform into A and vice versa. So SU2 cross SU2, those two SU2s are not exactly independent. They can be related by one transformation, which is parity. So that's something to keep in mind. And then left and right name will come from that. Okay, so if we want to then transform objects or characterize objects under the Lorentz symmetry, we can define objects that have specific transformations under the SU2 cross SU2, for example, having dimensions of a given spin, S1 and S2. And you can think on different objects, for example, an object that transforms as 0, 0, under the two SU2s is what you will call a scalar field. An object that transforms as a representation 1/2, 0 is what you will call a left-handed Weyl fermion. And often you put a thing like Seyel. The other guy will be a right-handed Weyl fermion. And if we have then something that transforms under both as a 1/2, 1/2, we are thinking of an object that, if you want, is made of a left-handed and right-handed Weyl fermions together. That's what we usually call a Dirac fermion.
Sorry, just
Now, let's quickly think about degrees of freedom. You probably heard and used the concept of degrees of freedom. Essentially, you want to define or to describe a field and how many real functions you will need to do so. So a real scalar, how many degrees of freedom is it? One. What about a vile left-handed fermion? If you think on this electron story of being electron up and electron down?
Two.
Two, very good. Same for right-handed, two and two. And what about a Dirac fermion? 4 degrees of freedom, excellent. It's often very useful to think in terms of degrees of freedom because it gives a clearer idea. Okay, so sometimes we think on then our vile fermion psi L and psi R, and the way we represent the Dirac fermion is precisely building something made of both a left and right-handed guy, like a vector that contains something that transforms under the first SU2 and another lower part that transforms under the second SU2. So you see, we have been able to write down these vile fermions and these Dirac fermions. Fermions are tricky, as you know already, but we are able to write them in ways that are consistent or in representations that are consistent with the symmetries of SU2 cross SU2, and hence they are consistent with the Lorentz invariance that we expect in nature. So it's thanks to that that we know that we have left-handed or right-handed things. The left and right is just a label, if you want, and it only has a meaning later on when we think about electroweak interactions. You have to call it left or right, it's just a name. And the fact of having a Dirac fermion and how to write a Dirac fermion, what are the consistent ways of writing a Dirac fermion, are also dictated by the Lorentz symmetry and by our ability to write it this way. That's what we do. Maybe we try to do this right now before the end of the class. So that this is done. Okay. So let's take fermions because they are the trickiest things. The way they have Lorentz transformations, they are spinors, but it's not as obvious as the case of the scalar doesn't have any Lorentz transformation, or it is invariant, or the case of a vector, for example, a photon or a W boson. You see the Lorentz index very clearly over here, right? That's my Lorentz index. That's the best way of representing this guy. But for fermions, their transformations under the Lorentz symmetry group are not that obvious because the way that we actually write them down and think about them is through this dual view of two SU2s. But they do transform with the Lorentz group. Okay, so if we want to write down a theory of fermions, we want to write the Lagrangian of my fermion, and I want this Lagrangian to be invariant under Lorentz transformations, what kind of terms can I write down? What things are allowed and not allowed? So the first thing I should tell you is that the same way that psi L is a left-handed guy, I can also build a right-handed guy out of it. Okay, I can take tau 2, the Pauli matrix tau 2, and I can take psi L, the vile fermion, and take the complex conjugate. If I do this, this guy will have the transformation properties of a right-handed fermion. So whereas this transforms under 1/2 0, this guy transforms under 0 1/2. So the aim is to write a Lagrangian that transforms in no way respect to SU2 cross SU2. So it's a singlet under this symmetry. Because then I know that my Lagrangian is going to be Lorentz invariant. So that's the M. Can I make up combinations of my fermions that do not have any kind of transformation, that they are essentially singlets under reciprocal reciprocity? And that dictates all the things you can do. In fact, I won't give you the details, but you end up with only few types of things you can do. All the invariants that you can write down are for your Dirac fermion. You can take the usual kinetic term, so your gamma mu derivative mu inside, and if you plug the transformations of SU2 cross SU2, you will see that's indeed an invariant. So your usual Dirac kinetic term, your Dirac Lagrangian, the form it has is unique and is the only way you can write down the kinetic term that is consistent with Lorentz symmetry. Yes?
What's special about tau 2? Why does that take you from half 0 to 0 half? Could you use tau 1?
I don't know if it's written here, but tau 2 has these i's over here.
Yeah.
So the fact that you need this i so that at the end of the day, this complex conjugate and your i work with each other to make
if a... If I use tau 1 and no star.
So the, let me maybe, you remember, you recall the form of tau 2?
Yeah.
It has something like 0 i minus i 0. So it's something that is going to change from the upper component to the lower component.
Yeah, so if I use tau 1, it's got 1, 1, and then no star.
But it doesn't have the minus sign.
What role does that minus sign play?
To make the whole thing invariant. sorry.
I'm just looking at the representations that...
See, I understand. I can give you more details, so we can go over the transformation of this fermion under the Lorentz symmetry, and then we can see how it transforms. I'm sure that is the handle. Then I'll find this slide in a second, but I can show you essentially why you need this complex conjugate and why you need a tau 2 from all the possibilities. And this tau 2 appears all the time, as you probably.
It's just always confused me. I don't really understand.
We can sit down and I'll show you. It's not like I don't have that particular slide here, but that's I first derived that this guy is right handed here. Yes.
Sorry, I just missed the point that you were making when you wrote down the...
0, 0?
Yeah.
Very good. Thank you. So, what are we starting with? We say... I can show him later, really. I can show him later. So we are starting... What we want, or we want to impose, is that there is this symmetry, Lorentz symmetry, and that is our principle. That's what we want to impose from up down. We want to, starting from that principle, write objects that are consistent with that symmetry, and from that derives equations of motion, the physics, and so on. Now, what I mean by that is that I want to write an object, the action, or if you want the derived Lagrangian, that is does not transform under the symmetry. So it's an invariant under the symmetry. What symmetry is that? It's my S of 3,1. It's my Lorentz symmetry. So I want to write a Lorentz invariant Lagrangian. But I'm writing this in terms of fields that do transform under SU2 cross SU2. So I just want to make sure to find combinations of these guys that lead to no transformation. And that means invariant. Is this more clear?
Right.
And that essentially determines everything. If I already have a derivative here, and I have these fields that have these specific transformations under SU2 cross SU2, the only thing I can do is to precisely put those guys, those gamma matrices, and that's all I can do. That's the Dirac equation. What about in terms of masses? There is a couple of possibilities. So that's the kinetic term, and that's done. This kinetic term can be written in terms of left and right fields as being side left dagger, tau 2 again, coming back to your question, and the derivative, and then the derivative. Sorry, a little bit later. So, obviously I'm tired. That's it. Okay, so this can be written in terms of the left and right-handed fields as this sigma mu. That's a sigma mu. Sorry, it's a sigma. Believe me. The mu is a left. And the same for left going to right. So left going to right. Where sigma mu is made of the identity and then the Pauli matrices over here. So this is the term I can write down. And in this term, you can see there is an explicit parity invariance because I can go from left to right and I get exactly the same Lagrangian. So this theory, this kinetic term of my Dirac field is Lorentz invariant and is parity invariant, where left and right are exchanged. What about mass terms? These are important, and there is a bit more game with the mass terms. And that will be it for today. Another term I can write with Dirac fields that is still a singlet under the my Lorentz transformation is precisely psi times psi, which in terms of my left and right fields is psi left dagger, psi right, and the Hermitian conjugate. All right. So this is a term I'm allowed to write, and it's a term that shows the or modifies the propagation of the left and right-handed fields. So it's a mass term. So if I add an M in front, if you want, that's precisely the description of a mass term for a Dirac particle. Okay, so all in all, if I want to write down what is the Lagrangian for a Dirac particle, for a Dirac fermion, there is only this option. I can write down psi dagger, then the derivative, and then I can put my mass term. And there is nothing else I can write at that level. Okay, so any questions so far? Yes, very good. At that level, oh, very good. So because I was going to say something else. So here, I'm written down a theory where the left and right particles are treated the same, right? It is parity invariant. There is absolute, what is left and what is right, there is no distinction between these two. But apart from this term, I'm also allowed to write down an additional mass term, type of mass term that is called a Majorana mass term. Now, a Majorana mass term is not allowed, or I'm not allowed to write this kind of term for a charged particle, like an electron or a quark. I'm only allowed to write a Majorana mass term for a neutral particle, for example, like the neutrino. In order to be able to write that particle, I need to write that particle Majorana's mass term. I need to assume that the particle and the antiparticle are the same. If that's the case, if there is something like this going on, as in neutrinos it could be, then I can write a Majorana mass term. But otherwise, I'm not allowed. So that's just Lorentz symmetry. And just finding the representations of a given spin of Lorentz symmetry, so spin 1/2, uniquely determines what kind of Lagrangian I can write for this fermion. And it tells me the equation, the Dirac equation, and it tells me what kind of symmetries are behind. Okay? Any questions? Everything is clear? I know that the fermions are a bit of a mess. Now, before we leave, I want to tell you one more thing. I think I have. Yes.
Just a quick question for me. What about higher derivative kinetic?
They could be there, indeed. And
but
then
we choose not to add.
We choose not to add them, indeed. No, that's an excellent question. So that's at the renormalizable level. We could have higher order terms, and we will impose Lorentz symmetry on them, so their structure will be determined by that. Indeed, so that's a very good question. And any more? Or for example, we could write a higher order term that contains four fermions. That's, for example, in BCS theory, you could write this kind of stuff. This is non-renormalizable, yet it's something interesting we could do. There is an interaction among four fermions. And I'm writing precisely this because that's the Lorentz invariant combination. I cannot write, for example, psi, and psi. That's not Lorentz invariant. So that determines how can I write them now. Okay? The only last thing before we depart is, apart from the symmetry I impose, which is Lorentz symmetry, and the symmetry of parity that I also possesses, there is another symmetry that this Lagrangian has. And it's a symmetry that, if you want, is an accidental symmetry because it appears from us imposing Lorentz symmetry. Then there is an additional symmetry, which is a phase transformation that I could do like this. I could take my psi and my psi dagger. That is a transformation. It's a phase transformation. It's a U1 that leads exactly this Lagrangian invariant. So you see, I imposed a symmetry from high up, and I obtain more symmetries out on the way, an accidental symmetry. This U1 is of a specific type. It's called, or leads to something called fermion number. And that's the reason why when you are doing your Feynman diagrams, you write an electron and you do an arrow. This arrow is not just decoration. It's actually telling you there is a conserved quantity that in any Feynman diagram you are traveling with has to preserve, which is this fermion number. I have an electron. Right? And the arrow is telling me that. Okay, so charged particles have contained this additional accidental symmetry, which then leads to fermion number conservation. Okay? And then we will see how there are other such accidental symmetries in the standard model. I think I killed you enough, okay? See you tomorrow. No.